Good morning. You're listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Kurt Wartney. It's the first Monday in February, and that means the parking lots are full surrounding that domed building at 23rd and Lincoln in Oklahoma City. The legislative session begins just about an hour from now at the state capitol. I've invited three people who I hope will help us learn more about what we might expect out of this session. In the studio, Keith Gaddy, University of Oklahoma political science professor and political analyst, and a new title for you starting in July. Keith, you'll be the head of OU's political science department. Welcome.
Good to be here, Kurt.
M. Scott Carter, who's the State Capitol Bureau Chief for the Journal Record newspaper. Scott, welcome.
Thank you.
And Sean Ashley, he's the news director at eCapitol. And you may recognize his name because we use their legislative news updates for KGOU. And Sean, welcome to you.
Good morning.
Before we dig into specific issues before lawmakers this session, I want to start with a discussion on the effect Dr. Tom Coburn's decision to leave his U.S. Senate seat 2 years early might have on the process and the people who guide it. Keith, first, would you kind of lay out the flowchart? I felt like I needed almost a scorecard of the people now running for different offices because of Senator Coburn's decision.
Well, you know, Kurt, the thing about political ambition in a federal system is it's sort of like a Pez dispenser, you know? You take out one piece of candy and everything else pops up. And, you know, when we talk about ambition, the hearts that reside in the hopes that reside in the hearts of young politicians, it's always moving up in some form or fashion. So when Dr. Coburn, who was planning on limiting out in 2 years anyway, decided to not seek reelection and to resign early, this triggered a special election to fill the last 2 years of his seat. So immediately you're thinking about the governor, you're thinking about every member of Congress, you're thinking about every surviving Democrat whose name someone can remember in the southeastern part of the state, all talking about making this run. So suddenly we've got congressmen looking at it like James Lankford. This opens up Congressional District 5, which has one-fifth of the legislature living in it. So suddenly you've got every state lawmaker who's approaching term limits considering making this run. And it just ripples out. And that's the beauty of American politics is you change one part near the top of the food chain and it just sets off all these changes down ticket.
Scott, in terms of the state capitol, what has this meant for what's going to be happening? And particularly, we're talking, of course, about the House and the Senate. But I'd like you to focus on what were the changes we're likely to see in the state House because of Senator Coburn's decision.
As everyone here knows, House Speaker T.W. Shannon decided he's going to seek Coburn's seat. And everyone here will tell you that you really can't serve as be an effective House Speaker and run for a statewide office like the United States Senate during the legislative session. So Shannon is kind of transitioning out, and this has led to a huge amount of jockeying in the 72-member Republican caucus on who's going to replace him. At the same time, on the Senate side, you have the Appropriations Chair making the CD5 bid. More fallout from Coburn's announcement. So the big leaders on both sides of the Capitol, they're in play, and I think for a while it's going to kind of destabilize things. I talked to several staff members who said, "Yeah, we're just waiting to see till the dust settles before we know who to take orders from."
And Sean, Scott mentioned the Congressional District 5 race and State Senator Clark Jolly, who's most important job at the Capitol is Senate Budget Committee Chairman, you're my go-to guy for all things budgets. What's it take to first of all be the Senate Budget Committee Chair? How much work is involved there, and do you think it's possible to run a congressional race at the same time?
Well, it's going to be rather interesting to see because, as you suggest, being Senate Appropriations Chair is one of the busier jobs in the Capitol, if not the busiest, along with House Appropriations and Budget. Because not only do you have the act of writing, being involved in writing the budget itself, which is a long and tedious process, it lasts all session, you're also looking at other pieces of legislation that could have effects on the budget. Changes in policies involving state agencies can cost money. It can take more money to deliver services. It can reduce the cost of those services. So you're keeping your eye on a lot of moving parts. Particularly when we get to May, as we begin to wind down toward the end of the legislative session, and you've got to get that budget finished. Can he run a congressional race at the same time? Apparently he intends to do so. Senate President Pro Tem Brian Bingaman said during the Associated Press legislative forum that Senator Jolly has assured him that he will be focused on his duties at the Capitol while competing in that congressional race. So we'll have to see.
Well, and it will be interesting because, as you indicated, that budget stuff really peaks toward the end of the session, which, you know, ends in at the end of May. And the primary is just, you know, a month after that. So that's going to be something to see, Keith.
Our calendar changed because of some changes in federal voting law. It used to be filing didn't occur until a week after the session ended. Now it's in early April. The primary was often late July or even early August. Now it's at the end of the June. And in CD5, it's possible we may have enough people in because in addition to Senator Jolly, we've got former Senator Russell jumping in. We have Commissioner Patrice Douglas jumping in. We have a variety of people looking at this contest, some of whom we're waiting to hear from yet. You're probably looking at a runoff, which will be 2 months after the primary. So, I mean, we're looking at a long calendar, and that means you need to raise a lot of money. And this brings up a variety of ethical issues concerning both federal candidates but also fundraising by current state lawmakers even if they're running for federal office. So Senator Jolly's life has gotten very complex very quickly as he continues to do both jobs.
Well, and when would we expect to see the dust settle in terms of – especially in the House? Do anybody have any crystal balls on that?
Well, I think the Speaker told his caucus that he was going to remain Speaker for the moment, you know, at present. And I think you'll see the dust settle when a true candidate to replace him emerges with enough votes. And I expect that would be a couple of weeks after session starts. I don't think it'll happen absolutely immediately. And there are several people out there now working to secure pledges to get enough votes. But there are also – that's a big caucus, and there are factions in it that are competing against each other right now for that leadership post, and it's going to be a while for that sifts out.
I want to play some audio clips for us. Sean, you mentioned the Associated Press Legislative Forum that you, Scott, and I were at this last week. And I'm going to play some audio from that to kind of help us get into the conversation about what's going on. And I want to start with Governor Mary Fallon, and she's talking about a little bit about what we might see in her executive budget.
Well, you will see in my budget and in my State of the State speech a tax cut for Oklahoma, and you'll have to come to find out what it is and what the budget will be. But I do believe, and I've always believed, that keeping our taxes low, but yet providing for essential services of our state, is an important goal for the state of Oklahoma.
So keeping taxes low, providing for central services, core services of the state. Sean, as I said, you're my budget guru guy. Where are we? Just give me the big picture view of where we are in terms of how much money lawmakers have, how does it compare to years before, and what we might see out of the governor's executive budget.
Well, when the Board of Equalization met in late December, they approved a revenue estimate that's about $171 million less than the just over $5 billion that was appropriated for the current fiscal year. So that's a pretty good gap to fill. The board will meet again in a couple of weeks and certify a new number, and Governor Fallon and her finance secretary, Preston Dorflinger, seem confident that there's going to be some additional revenue. There's not going to be an additional $171 million, however, because when you look at those numbers, what you see are some slowing in areas like the sales tax collections and some declines in corporate income tax and in individual income tax collections. How the governor balances that, sort of like she hinted in the audio clip, we'll see that on Monday. When you talk about cutting the individual income tax, if you're going to do it effective January 1, 2015, that's going to increase that difference from $171 million to whatever the effect of that income tax cut is. So she has a lot of work to do to balance that budget.
And Scott, we also heard that it seems like the state Senate overall, because when we heard from Minority Leader Sean Burridge and also from Senate President Pro Tem Brian Bingaman, it seems like the Senate's a little – we're not quite 100% on this. First, let's hear what Senator Burridge had to say.
My question is, whenever we're looking at already $170 million less to spend than last year, we're talking about additional tax cuts. I think at the very out front of that discussion, you need to tell me where you're going to cut. Where are you going to cut in our budget? That lost revenue, where's it going to come from? Is it going to come from education? Is it going to come from corrections? Is it going to come from health care. I think that's the discussion that needs to be had before you start talking about tax cuts.
So, Scott, we've heard this before, haven't we?
Yeah, Sean Burge is kind of the conscience of the Senate. He reminds people you're going to have to, you know, pay for this one way or pay for this another, and which way do you want to go? But he's right on there. If you go in with $171 million down, some agency's going to have to give up something. There's not going to be the money. There are calls for pay increases for state employees. The governor wanted to wait until after a performance study was done that was completed last fall. There's a big push for corrections and public safety employees to get a pay increase, and all the other things going on. Burge is right. Where are you going to cut? I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not sure where they would, what agency they would go after. He later in that same thing, the senator talked about education being down about $200 million since 2008. Sean, correct me if I'm wrong.
That's the number.
I think that's right. And that's a huge issue for Common Ed in Oklahoma because teachers haven't seen a pay raise in several years. So,
Keith, what does it mean in terms of where are we politically in this whole tax cut discussion? Because this has been the theme ever since the Republican takeover.
You can always count on any Republican in the country running on tax cuts. Let's start with that. It's in the mantra. The second thing you can count on is that there will be demands for new programs coming from the same people that want to cut taxes. So it's not just that we have this $171 million hole that Scott had mentioned previously. It's also that we're going to put new expenditures on top of that. One thing we have to remember about BEQ, Board of Equalization estimates, is they're based upon 95% of the projected revenue coming in. So there's a little bit here that might be played with in theory, especially if it looks like the revenue projections turn out to be better than we thought. But they still have to balance based upon that 95% projection. And this ripples into all the political campaigning going on because we have a whole bunch of Republican leaders all running for different stuff, none of whom want to be seen being for a tax cut, but they also need to deliver on previous expenditure promises that they've made. So we're back to the same tune that we've been hearing since 2004 when the Republicans first took over the state house. We've been at this for a decade, and they keep bumping up against this number when it comes to the income tax that they just can't get passed without rolling a log. And now they got to try and take the stuff that they rolled as a log last year that the Supreme Court said they couldn't do due to the single subject rule, and now they got to try and fix it without being able to cut the deals they needed to do it.
And it's probably worth noting that not only are those individuals we spoke of earlier running for office, you also have Governor Fallon who's seeking reelection, as well as all the members of the House and half the Senate. And Governor Fallon, except for House Bill 2032, which was found to be unconstitutional, has yet to pass a tax cut.
You mentioned the Supreme Court decision, and I want to hear from Democratic leader Scott Emmett in the House side and hear what he had to say about that.
Well, I can tell you one thing. When I stood up on the House floor at the end of last session and said that this tax cut / capital improvements package is unconstitutional, I have never been more grateful and proud to have been right in my life. Because if the Oklahoma Supreme Court had not ruled it unconstitutional, instead of $170 million worth of cuts to common education, health care, and public safety, Oklahoma would be looking at nearly $300 million in cuts to common education, health care, and public safety. And this is a time in which common education has seen a 22.8% cut over a 5% period, over a 5-year period, deeper than any other state in the nation.
I want to address first the Supreme Court in that because the State Chamber of Commerce, current House Speaker T.W. Shannon, have both said that judicial reforms in the way we elect and appoint judges in Oklahoma, they really want to take a look at that and change that. Is this an attack on the co-equal branch of government, or are these changes that are overdue in your opinions?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
While these changes may not be the changes that are needed, it's never a bad idea to go back and reexamine how you engage in selection and retention in government. It's never a bad thing to talk about ways you can modernize and make things better. But yeah, this is an attack on the judiciary. If the judiciary had not been throwing this stuff out, we wouldn't be talking about reform.
And at the same time, the judiciary is throwing this stuff out because of what the legislature has done. Yeah. I mean, House Bill 2032, for example, again, the court was very specific. You have a tax issue, the tax cut that was in Title 68, and then you have the capital repair money, which is in Title 76, I believe, state buildings and state capital. So it all goes hand in hand. Speaker T.W. Shannon's not the first to consider this. As someone pointed out recently, there are two bills that have two resolutions that have already passed the Senate that are sitting in the House that were authored by Senator Clark Jolly that would do some of the same things Speaker Shannon is advocating, creating a new retention policy, setting term limits, and age limitations. They could move very quickly on those if they chose to do so.
Well, the interesting thing, though, is this fight – I think this fight over the Supreme Court and it is primarily focused on the Supreme Court. There's been less mentioned about the lower appellate judiciary, such as the Court of Criminal Appeals and the Court of Civil Appeals. But this fight at the Supreme Court goes back to the waning days of the Henry administration. And if you think back when Glenn Coffey was Senate pro tem, they went after the Judicial Nominating Commission after late Justice Marian Opala passed away just months before Governor Henry's term ended. The JNC moved quickly and sent the governor names to fill after a previous – and I forgot what Supreme Court justice before that. It may have been Hargrave, but one of them retired. And so Henry, in the waning hours of his administration, literally down to I think in December was when it was finalized, managed to appoint two more Supreme Court justices. And it was – most of it was due to timing and things like that. But it happened then. Right after that, the Senate went after the Judicial Nominating Commission, passed a bill, got a constitutional amendment through that added more members to the JNC and started going after the judiciary. And it was – I think it was in response to the fact that a Democratic governor got to appoint six members of the Oklahoma Supreme Court. That really concerned them.
And the Oklahoma Bar Association is now starting an effort to educate people on how this all works and basically in support of the current system. Because in the past, Oklahoma's had some issues with Supreme Court justices. We've had some troubles there.
That's been a half century. I mean, things have to have changed a little bit. It's
well, to be honest, the it's a hybrid of the Missouri plan, and it's worked really well since that time. There's been no scandals. There's been no bribery. The JNC is by and large a group of very dedicated people who've worked very hard to vet and provide candidates for the governor to choose from. And I think it's functioned really well.
Well, you know, there is an issue this raises, and this is where the politics can get funny. Okay. There's an effort here to shift more power towards the legislature and shift power away from the judiciary. Okay. But if we trusted the legislature so much, why did we term limit them?
Good question.
I'm just curious. If I were an opponent to this reform, that's the question I would ask because you've already got retention on judges. You can get rid of them if you want to, okay? And we may see some of those efforts underway at some point in the near future. We know from research that term limits, generally speaking, don't really work that well. They're not really good for institutions. So we now have a movement underfoot saying, well, you know, if I'm term limited, everybody ought to be limited. So let's take a bad idea and apply it to everybody. And that's the other manifestation here.
Well, and the other thing is that whenever the Supreme Court makes a decision that lawmakers, the governor, agree with, they're praised. I mean, the news releases are almost comical. I mean, in my opinion, when they overturned the state tax cut and the capital legislation and said this is log rolling, and the news releases come out about how we've got to change this, this is awful, and then they support the workers' compensation plan that was put in place, and the news releases come out saying
these
are the best people in the world.
Of course.
It's
well,
kind of crazy.
I think you have to consider too. This stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum. When they passed the bill about the Capitol and the tax cut, half the Democratic caucus on both sides stood up and said, "Guys, this is unconstitutional. You'll be in court. They'll throw it out." They were warned. The ink was not dry on the bill before Oklahoma City Attorney Jerry Fint said, "I'm going to court over this." Jerry Fint has made a career, or at least a terrific hobby, of holding the legislature's feet to the fire for the Oklahoma Constitution. And so it's not like the court just looks at the bill and says, well, we think it's ungood. Somebody sparks that interest in the legislation to begin with.
Yeah, the court can't act on its own.
No, it's not acting on its own. It's in response to a suit that has been brought to it. And the legislature was warned about this long before, I mean, all during the process that bill was being developed. They were told this is unconstitutional. They chose to act differently.
So maybe there'll be term limits for Jerry Fent.
You know what, Jerry, I don't think you're going to shut Jerry down. I think Jerry has he's found a calling, and he's going to ride in there when he thinks it's important.
So he's that fourth branch of government that Congressman from the second district was talking about.
I don't know whether he's a fourth or maybe even a fifth branch, but he doesn't give up easily. I'll say that.
The second part about what Democratic leader Inman said was about the education cuts, and we keep hearing about more cuts in the income tax, which means reduction in revenue most likely, and that means that something's going to have to go. But Governor Fallon is still sticking by her guns on this, and I want to hear what she had to say about that.
I still think it's prudent policy to look at government spending, to look at ways to create more efficiency, and you'll hear me talk about this in my State of the State speech, to eliminate wasteful spending, to make government work more efficient, more effective, and to save money. And you will see me propose some revenue, spending cuts in our budget.
Streamline, we've heard that from the first time, her first campaign speech, I believe, we heard that and keep hearing that, and additional cuts. Any guesses about where that's going to come from, Sean?
Well, I don't think you'll see it in some of those major agencies that were mentioned earlier. I think, for example, Common Education, which is asking for more money, will likely see some additional money. I'm not sure what we'll see in the budget regarding the Department of Corrections because they've just hired a new director who doesn't come into this next month, and there are a lot of issues at play there. But I think what you will see, particularly in some of the smaller agencies, and during the forum the other day, the governor sort of started to talk about something, but then she backed away from it. It was related to a question on the Arts Council, and she talked about sort of reducing budgets, but almost like it might not be a total reduction or there might be some revenue coming in another way. It was all very vague and convoluted. But what that led me to believe, having looked at her budgets over the years, is that we will see, as she said, targeted cuts, particularly in some of the smaller agencies or maybe even within larger agencies that can rely on fees or other revenue to support particular programs.
I think one of the things you're going to see from the governor, and this has kind of been playing out for the past couple of years, and I'm going to defend the governor on this. We have a chief executive who doesn't have the authority to directly affect policy at a state agency, even though they're executive branch agencies. Fallon had this problem with the Department of Human Services. She had this problem with the State Department of Veterans Affairs. She had this department with the Department of Corrections, the Pardon and Parole Board, things like that. I think you're going to see the governor call to eliminate several of those boards and eliminate the funding for them, eliminate the staff for them, maybe roll some of the staff into the agency, but do some streamlining there to give her more authority to go in. And that it's probably a good idea because when as we saw with the Department of Veterans Affairs, there were all these problems that were dumped in the governor's lap and she didn't have the authority to fix them. And I don't think you should hamstring a chief executive like that. You either give them the authority to go in and make changes and do it. They did that with DHS, and it finally seems that they're beginning to right that big DHS ship. I think you're going to see a call for that again, especially it's happened even with the Construction Industries Board and other groups. There have been pushes to give the governor more authority.
And there already is a bill filed related to the Board of Corrections to eliminate the board
exactly
and allow the governor to hire the director.
Well, and this is politically a smart move for any governor. Governors who get to reorganize government, streamline it, cut down on agencies, get rid of old redundancies, that's always popular. I mean, I know Governor Fallon may not appreciate this, but it's what made Jimmy Carter look successful when he ran for president, was that he had reorganized Georgia state government, and it had an impact. You know, the question is, can you find 4% of the budget in this effort at reorganization or the elimination of these boards? Can you find 4% of a $5-point-something-billion budget to make cuts to bring things into balance?
And two, I think the legislature is getting a little cautious. Several years ago, we began the process of consolidating information technology within state agencies. For some state agencies, that's worked out very well. For others, it hasn't. And legislators these past couple of weeks have been hearing from agencies who are now asking to somehow get out of that, particular smaller agencies. They want their IT people back, or they want to be able to do their IT a different way, because bringing that all in under one umbrella is costing them more money.
This kind of goes to another issue I want to talk about, a language that is often heard on the floor of the legislature and from the governor, words like local control. We want to, you know, one size doesn't fit all. However, we have these movements toward consolidation that seem to run counter to that, and the IT is one of those main examples. Or is this a trend, Keith? It's something we're going to continue to see, do you think?
Well, you know, movements towards local control, movements towards modernization. We've been talking about this for 20 years in state government. And, you know, the first wave of this, everybody forgets, was privatization. And that was Frank Keating. What can we do to privatize things or move them out? And there was a lot of reform in state government that went on in the 90s under Governor Keating working with the Democratic legislature. But yeah, we're going to keep coming back to this. But if we're serious about it, that means we also take a careful look at the structure of local government and ask questions about its organization, where savings exist down there. Because there are also savings to be realized in state government through things like local school reorganization.
What about county commissioners? I mean, every 77 counties, and we have three county commissioners times 77. Well, that's a lot of people.
Well, that's if we went to a Kansas model where you'd have a professional county manager with elected county commissioners to oversee them, you could cut 2/3 of the county commissioners in terms of their salaries, consolidate garages, and have a much more efficient delivery of county services in the rural counties. But that will not be popular.
No, they would show up with torches and pitchforks and circle the Capitol.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they would.
There are only 231 of them, Scott.
They're loud.
Well, and that does get at, you know, some of these issues are so big and they get so complicated. And when we talk about budget and budget cuts, really, the areas that are flexible for spending are pretty small, really, to a percentage basis. I mean, we have certain things in Oklahoma that we spend a lot of money on. I mean, education, of course, is one. Human services, things like that. How much of a percentage is that of the budget?
It's a really large portion. Several years ago, former Treasurer Scott Meacham pointed out that something like the top seven agencies of state government eat up approximately 85% of all appropriated dollars. I don't know exactly what those numbers would be today. But there's not a lot of wiggle room out there. However, during a recent budget hearing, State Finance Director Preston Dorflinger said he thought most state agencies could probably still cut their budgets 3-5%. Yeah. Some state agency leaders were shocked to hear that and were asking, tell me where that is. So there is an attitude within Governor Fallon's administration that there still are cuts that can be made and reductions that can be implemented and services still delivered.
Preston Dorflinger also said that he was concerned that the legislature has actually earmarked money again and again through the legislative process that hamstrings the appropriations process and doesn't allow flexibility for those things, so that if the administration and lawmakers decided to want to move a significant amount of money from an area to the other, they can't in some ways.
Well, you look at the transportation plan, the funding for that 8-year transportation plan comes right off the top. So when you take that off the top and you give them a remainder, like Sean said, you're getting down to about 15% of what flows in.
It's really interesting. State taxes generate approximately $10 to $11 billion of revenue a year. Yet the legislature appropriates only half that amount, about $5 billion. The rest of it, like Scott pointed out, is dedicated to specific purposes, transportation, the Higher Learning Access program, and a plethora of other programs. In fact, if you look at the spreadsheet on the computer, it goes into the double A, double A, B, A, Z. In order to print it out and look at it, the tax commission prints it out on a 24 by 36 piece of poster board. So it's really wow. interesting to see how over time we've dedicated revenue these ways. If you look over time, what the legislature has done, I looked at some preliminary numbers that showed like over 7 years, the legislature has reduced the amount of money it has available by appropriation by about $1 billion by setting it aside to all these other – dedicating it to all these other programs. They could be spending $1 billion more if they hadn't dedicated that revenue.
I think that's part of it is – they don't trust themselves.
Right.
Or they take the Higher Learning Access Act, the Oklahoma Promise Scholarship. It's $60, $70 million a year. If they had to fight for that every year, at some point they would stop.
Yeah.
If they didn't take it off the top, if they didn't do some earmarks, some of those programs, which are probably good programs, would go by the wayside. So I think there's some built-in inherent distrust of themselves or whatever – then that's why those happen.
Well, and you know, if you're a lawmaker, especially in a term-limited legislature, if there's a program out there that you want to have funded, if you can put it beyond politics, you're going to do that. That's what happens is we've taken half of our revenue and put it beyond politics where it doesn't come on the table and doesn't get negotiated. So it's one way to ensure that if you're trying to build on or sustain a legacy, it's an easy way to do so.
This is Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Kurt Courtney. That was Keith Gaddy, and we're also talking with M. Scott Carter and Sean Ashley doing an overview preview of the legislative session, which begins today. One of the other issues that I think we may see some conflict on is over bonds and how to fund certain projects using that form of indebtedness, and it is a form of debt. The governor and State Senate President Pro Tem Brian Bingaman both have indicated their willingness to have bond issues, in particular for fixing the state capitol, maybe for the OK Pops Museum in Tulsa, the American Indian Cultural Center Museum in Oklahoma City. House Speaker Pro Tem Mike Jackson, he had something else to say on that issue.
I think that pay-as-you-go is the best option. And I think that making sure that we are not increasing that debt is something that our caucus does genuinely support, or at least generally support. And I think that moving forward, that plan would not alter.
So no bonds. And Governor Fallon made the point that our indebtedness is really getting ready to, in the, over the next 4 years, to really decrease. And we're going to get rid of these bonds that are coming up in just a short period of time. So what's the problem here?
It's a philosophical problem. And you think about it, the bonds we're about to retire, our higher interest bonds were issued in the 80s. So if we take on new debt now, we're going to take it on at a much lower interest rate, which means that we can take on more debt for less cost in terms of bond maintenance. It's a political thing. It is about this philosophy of running government as business and you should pay as you go, even though most businesses, you will discover, depending upon their nature, have to take on bonds for guarantee in order to ensure that they can pay their debts and often run substantial lines of credit that are even unsecured. State government can only run secured debt, and that's what the bonds do. Pay-as-you-go works if you're flush with new cash, and at present we see that we are not.
I think part of that too is it's at least with the House Republican caucus, they really like to take a federal issue and put a state stamp on it. And the issue of Oklahoma's debt is not even comparable to the federal government, but we have the federal government solution for a state problem. That's part of that politics there too, is we've federalized state debt and it doesn't work. You're going to have to sell bonds at some point to provide for infrastructure, and the House Republican caucus is probably going to run up against Jackie Chan, Arnold Schwarzenegger combination of the governor and the Senate, because I think both of those other two branches of government are likely to embrace bonds. And I think we're in for a big fight over bonds.
I think Scott's exactly right. This could be the big budget issue of the year, is whether or not we issue bonds and if the House is going to be able to hold its ground. If you attend a meeting of the Long Range Capital Planning Commission today, They were asked for better than $3 billion of capital improvements throughout state government, buildings that need repair. Some agencies bypassed that process and have gone directly to the legislature. One agency was asking for $3.1 million for a new heating and air system. There are a lot of needs out there, not to mention just the state capital itself. And until there's some movement, and like Scott said, where you may have the governor and the Senate teaming up against the House, and you have Senate Republicans and Democrats agreeing on that issue, so that makes them even that much stronger, I believe, it could be a big fight in the budget.
Well, and the votes on this that have come this last session were really close. So are we going to see any movement, do you think?
Well, this is where it gets really messy and it gets wrapped back up in the Senate race and in the House race, okay? Because, you know, Speaker Shannon was one that was at their last session really holding the line on this, insisting on pay-as-you-go. If he's left the House and his quiet but strong hand over the caucus is not there, can you hold that line? Can you hold those groups together? If he's still in the House, can he hold them together as different factions vie to succeed him? And finally, does he want to get into this entire mess as he's attempting to win a Republican primary? I mean, it really is – if you know, I'm not Speaker Shannon, but if I were him, I would like to get out of the speakership before this issue comes up so that other people can fight over it.
Well, and the issue related to debt has already been brought up in the Senate race. Congressman Langford was attacked the day after he announced by some of the state Tea Party groups. And one of the things they pointed out, and it's a different issue, but it does relate to debt, was that he voted in favor of raising the U.S. debt ceiling. So that issue is already out there in that campaign. So what Speaker Shannon does on the House floor or even in caucus is going to play into that Senate race.
Well,
and vice versa.
I think it could, but it also depends on timing. If Shannon, because Shannon enters the race right now with a terrific, as far as his supporters are concerned, a terrific anti-bond stance. Right. If he gets out before they start doing bond negotiations in the Senate and the House, then he's okay. I mean, he goes in with a clean record. I had a House staffer tell me the other day, with Shannon gone, we'll finally get the bonds on the table and we'll get some stuff done. I think Sean's right. There's going to be bond debt, and the issue of bonds may emerge as one of the really good fights during the session, because everything is in play and there's two strong supporters and a weakened opponent now.
And the fun part about bond arguments.
And was that fun about bond? I can't believe you said the fun part of bonds in the same sentence, Sean.
Well, from a reporter's standpoint, the fun part about bond arguments is once you reach an agreement to issue bonds, everybody then is knocking on your door because they want to be part. They want to be on the project list. They want that new heating and air system. They want their roof replaced. They want a new building.
A junior college in their district needs a gymnasium.
And so you sort of see how strong your potentially new leadership is then as to how tightly they can keep that controlled.
And what Sean's brought up that I'll say a little less nicely is it becomes porculous. You know, at what point does this just become a vehicle for moving selective benefits to selective lawmakers through the forms of bonded projects?
Yep. And it is an election year.
Somewhere there's a James Bond joke here. I'm really trying to find
it. Another issue that tends to draw fire that the legislature passed some time ago, but now it's become a focus, and that's what is typically called Common Core education standards. And we do have a group of lawmakers that are suspicious of this and conflate it with some kind of federal government the takeover of public education, while the State Department of Education is moving forward. And, of course, now we have Superintendent Janet Breese facing what appears to be a fairly strong primary opponent in the form of former State Board of Education member Joy Hoffmeister in Tulsa. So what are we likely to see along that fight about education? I know education funding is going to be a big issue, but everybody kind of, I think, they're more on the same page about funding. But what about these education standards?
The governor supported Common Core. The was a product of the National Republican Governors Association. But it's really rankled the Tea Party right in the House caucus. I don't know whether that same attention or that same level of concern exists in the Senate side, though. I haven't seen it amongst members of the Senate like I have members of the House.
Well, I think it's going to be a fight, and it again gets interesting because Speaker Shannon in the latter part of the last legislative session was becoming more and more vocal in his opposition.
Yeah,
to
his comments started off kind of on the edge, and they moved more and more toward the "we need to stop this."
Right, and there was some legislation filed last year that would try to undo it in Oklahoma, and finally they had to settle on passing the final day of the legislative session a simple House resolution that basically said we don't like it. But as you look at this legislative session, there are a number of bills, some that explicitly get rid of Common Core and take back our education standards to the priority academic student skills, others that just refer to state standards. I think there's a fight to be had there. I think Scott is very correct in when he says that for the Senate, it's not that big of an issue. I think they're content with those standards and don't want to fight over them. But the House will be firing some shots at the Senate with some legislation to get rid of it.
And the chamber folks generally are also supportive of this. When I've gone to the legislative previews and looked at the information from the state chamber, the Oklahoma City Chamber, they're both pretty much in support of this.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is there's opposition to this on both sides of the aisle. The left and the right can both get behind not being behind Common Core. But, you know, for the business community, they're always looking for a well-trained workforce. And, you know, for the last decade, the last two decades, Oklahoma City has gone its own way trying a different model of economic development. But by supporting Common Core, this signals that the state chamber is coming back to the notion of statewide development, statewide workforce, even though the main thing that's changed in terms of education in the state of Oklahoma in the last two decades is we've increased our rate of high school graduates. Sometimes significantly. In fact, we're ahead of the national average for high school graduation rate. Okay, but we're not doing any better on college education. We're not doing any better on VOTEC certification. We're not doing any better on developing the kind of quality workforce, skilled workforce that employers are looking for. So anything that takes us back to those standards has to help. But you know, at the end of the day, you know, everybody that's afraid of Common Core as some national takeover of standards seems to have forgotten No Child Left Behind. You know, we've been down this road before. We've done this before.
Well, and some of those on the more progressive side have basically called Common Core the sibling of No Child Left Behind.
Yeah, and you know, so we've got this situation. The national government got into state education through the back door through desegregation and started using its lever on desegregation and through the Great Society to pump money into programs and to use education as a vehicle to provide social services where needed or to advance early childhood education. And that's how the national government got into state education, and the school system stepped up and said, there's money here. We should do this. We will do these things. And then as we take those federal dollars, we complain that the feds want to actually attach terms to getting those dollars, or that people want to actually see objective improvement that can be measured. So the same folks that want to run government like a business object when we use business style metrics to assess performance.
I want to switch our topic too. I don't want to be sure we get in corrections and talk about the Department of Corrections and Oklahoma's prison system, which has been close to full forever, it seems like. And the funding for corrections last session, it was very clear early on that Governor Fallon's administration, they were not going to give really any more money to corrections. Now we have a new director coming in, as you mentioned earlier, Sean, and we have the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, which Governor Fallon said she did not know was going to cost money up front. I have a hard time believing that she did not know that, but she did say that. And Senate President Pro Tem Bingaman also mentioned that he was disappointed in that reform program that could have saved the state lots of money in the future with an investment on the front end was not being fully funded. Are we going to see this shift? Are we going to see the JRI come back, or is it pretty much gone? Are we going to see something different? Any opinions on how corrections and changes to our criminal justice system might look this session?
go back to 2011, and during the fall, there was an interim hearing of, I think it was the House's Criminal Justice Committee, or the equivalent of the Criminal Justice, and Health and Mental Health Secretary Terry White spoke there and offered the legislature a plan that she called Smart on Crime. It was going to cost about $100 million, and it was basically the state version of the JRI. It was earmarking nonviolent offenders toward drug courts and drug treatment and preemptive treatment and all the things that were included in the JRI. And everyone was supportive of it. They were trying to figure out where to come up with all the money needed, but everyone from the governor on down was supportive of it. Well, when the Justice Reinvestment Initiative was launched, it in court, White was there, and she even acknowledged that it incorporates a lot of what she urged the lawmaker and the governor to do. And they knew then that the price tag was at least $100 million. So the argument that I didn't know it was going to cost any money is kind of falls on deaf ears. It really doesn't work. The whole thing with JRI is it's political. We want to be seen as tough on crime, and it doesn't. Some people on the right don't see it that way, and they pushed the governor and pushed others to back off from it. But at some point, something's got to give, because out there, if you go back to 1978, the legacy of Luther Bohannon taking control of the Oklahoma Department of Corrections, and people don't remember that we didn't come out from under federal control until 2003. That was just a little more than a decade ago. And now we're already back in the same problem.
And the case you're referring to, and it was federal judge Luther Bohannon, and Oklahoma's prison system was basically taken over and operated by the feds.
By the federal courts.
Let's be honest. We are the incarceration capital of the world. Yeah, we have one of the highest rates of incarceration in a country that has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. And if we're going to do this, we have to be able to pay for it. We have to be able to do it well. We have to be able to do it effectively, because even prisoners have human rights. But so too, the thing that gets lost in this conversation, so too do the corrections employees. And we have a needlessly violent and dangerous situation in the state prisons. And it's been exacerbated year after year after year by the behavior of the legislature and the governor, both Democratic and Republican. This is a bipartisan failure, and I'm sure Sean has more on this.
Well, no, that's exactly right. When I was in college in the mid-80s down in Lawton, Oklahoma, the director of the Department of Corrections came and talked to us as they were preparing to implement early release. Well, a few years down the road, we got rid of early release and started working with private prisons and doing a whole bunch of other things. And then when I came to the Capitol in 1996, we were talking about truth in sentencing, getting the hardcore criminals into the prison, keeping them there as long as they needed to be, but not incarcerating those who should be in treatment programs and other things. That didn't pass. Here we are again, years down the line, and we're looking at JRI, we're looking at Smart on Crime. It's a perpetual concern for, as Keith points out, the state that incarcerates more people than anybody on a per capita basis.
Well, and Professor Gaddy's right too when he talks about correction employees. The 7-Eleven, two blocks from my house at 122nd and Council, has a sign in its window that offers a starting salary of $12.70 per hour to new employees. A state corrections employee, a beginning Department of Correction employee, starts at $11.83 an hour. You can make more at 7-Eleven than you can working for the Department of Corrections.
And in the Department of Corrections, you're face to face with somebody who likely killed someone.
You're in a life-threatening situation. Right. That's wrong.
And they also can't not show up for work. That was one of the things that if somebody doesn't show up for work, I should say, that person that's already there is stuck.
Well, all of us have had to go to these prisons for various professional reasons. And you meet these people who are dedicated and trained and overworked. And I mean, these are
underpaid.
And they embody everything that people talk about that are supposed to be the virtues of the Oklahoman. These are people that are doing the public's work with a great deal of spirit and faith to carry them through it. And they have no thanks and no support from us whatsoever.
And as you said, this is not new to Oklahoma, and I'm sure that the lawmakers will solve this problem along with the governor and the judiciary this session, along with all the other things we talked about, or maybe not. First, want to know any predictions as we close, any surprises, anything that you're particularly watching that that maybe other people should want to look at?
I don't know what it is, but they will pass something that will be overturned by the Supreme Court.
That's a pretty safe bet, I think, Keith. How about you, Scott?
I would pay attention to the stuff on horizontal drilling. I think that it's really going to be interesting because it's a kind of a really nice political moment for at least the governor's office, because if you can't be a Republican controlled legislature and governor in an election year and pass a tax increase. But that incentive is set to expire in 2015. So you can play it one of two ways. You can go in and say, if you're the progressive side, you can go in and say, well, we're going to have to increase it from 1% to 3 or 4% because you guys have to do your share. And it's either that or it goes up to 7%. And if you're on the conservative side, you can go in and say, well, it wasn't going to go up to 7%, but we held it down to 3 or 4%. So you can spin it either way and still come out on top. So it looks like something will get done on that. The fun part will be the arguments involved and the debate used to steer what is expected to be a small bump in that tax rate up. I think that will be fun to watch.
I think this will be one of the most interesting budget years, both because of the situation financially, the various competing interests, the horizontal drilling, the bonds, the fact that you have the Senate Appropriations Chairman running for Congress. There are so many moving parts there, so many opportunities to do great things or for there to be a complete train wreck that it'll be very interesting to watch.
Sean Ashley, News Director at eCapital, and Scott Carter, State Capital Bureau Chief for the Toronto Record Newspaper, and Keith Gaddy, OU Political Science Professor, and soon to be head of OU's Political Science Department. Thank you all so much for coming in, and I'm sure we'll be talking with you as the session goes on.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Kurt.
Enjoyed it.